Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast, a showcase of the world's black graphic designers, and web developers. I'm Maurice Cherry, and before we get started, I wanted to remind you about our survey. It only takes a few minutes to complete, and your feedback will really help shape the future of Revision Path. Just go to revisionpath.com/survey to fill it out. We're also now available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can just visit revisionpath.com/iTunes or revisionpath.com/Stitcher to subscribe. Make sure to rate us 5 stars and write us a review as well. The more downloads, subscribers, 5-star ratings, and reviews that we get, the more we can get the word out about the show. This week I talked with Kat Small, a UX designer and developer in New York City. Here we go.
Okay, so tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Kat Small. I was born in the Bronx, New York, and I am a UX designer and developer. Currently, I work at Bedrock Media Ventures, which is a small, sort of startup that does a lot of media production stuff, and they make a lot of videos, and we're building their content management system, and it's really just a really fun, interesting thing to do. You know, I've always loved making things, and web development has just made that so much easier.
Nice. How long have you been with Bedrocket?
It's been about 8 months now, so pretty recent. I was previously working at NASDAQ OMX. I was working on their, what was it called? It was like a they're sort of like service suite for people who need to release press releases. So I was helping to design the system around that, and that was also really fun.
Nice. How did you get started with technology? How did you sort of, what was the spark that made you decide this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I've always actually had a computer in front of my face. An infant even, there are actually pictures of me and my dad, and he's sort of like sitting at the computer and I'm in his lap, and we're sort of like just playing with it. And it was like the days of like the black screen and like the green or the white text. And there's also like my mom loves to tell the story about how my mom and I would just play this game where we'd like make train tracks in MS-DOS. And it was like totally ridiculous. But, I've just always had this connection with technology. And so as I got older and I realized that I really liked to make art, technology just sort of like, computers just became another way for me to do that. When I was about 12 years old, I started creating these interactive dolls. And so I would go into MS Paint and I would create all these ridiculous outfits and stuff. And then I would go into this program that was like specifically made for coding these dolls, and I would just like make them for hours, and I would just sit there and write in this random scripting language that was created by someone in Japan, and I did that for like 2 years, and I figured, you know, I have to make a website for these, so I learned to make a website when I was like 12 years old, and I also obviously messed with like AOL Home and stuff, because everyone who was like 6 years old and had a computer did that. But, I've just always been kind of attached to technology, and it's always sort of allowed me to be creative in ways that I would have never imagined otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I just always knew that I had to do something related to it.
Nice. And it sounds like, you know, and this is just based off of what we've got so far, that you kind of are involved in a lot of different types of not design, but you do design, you do development, based on what you said, then you also do some illustration. It sounds like it's good to sort of be a jack of all trades when it comes to this industry, because you can work in a lot of different types of fields, and maybe you can bring a different perspective to certain fields, right?
Yeah, totally. I've always found that the more you can do, the more powerful you are as a person. And I'm also really impatient, so I hate waiting for other people to finish things so that I can actually move ahead with stuff. So any time where that's ever happened, I've actually had to, like, learn how to do it by myself. And, yeah, I mean, technology is just so empowering. And any time that I look at someone and I say, I want to know how to do that, you know, I can just, like, find a way to learn how to do it and make it happen. So, like, even with making games, you know, when I was a kid, I would, like, look at Japanese RPGs and ask, like, how can I make one of these? And I went online and found RPG Maker. And when I wanted to learn how to make a website, you know, at the time they didn't, they had like tutorials and they were accessible. So, you know, I would use those and then like books and just figure it out. But, yeah, I mean, technology is just great in that there's like always a way to figure out something that you want to do. And sometimes that's not really possible with a lot of other things. So it just makes every person feel like they're just really powerful and it's really, just really interesting to be a part of it.
Yeah, I know that for a while in the tech and design industry about specialization versus, I guess, like being a jack of all trades. So there's a thing about should designers code, should developers design, you know, that kind of thing. But it really helps, like you said, it really helps to have knowledge of both.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just like when you don't have to wait for someone to do something, you know, it's just amazing. And also, like, just being able to communicate with someone on their level and, like, understand what it takes to build something is great. And so that's the thing about, like, should designers code? I mean, I'm always going to have that bias of, like, I know how to code. And I feel like everyone who makes stuff for, like, a technology platform, like, if you make something for a website, you should at least know how that thing is made. So even if you don't write code, per se, you should know, at least like the limits and the logic of whatever, you know, like the code that your project is going to be built in, because that's always going to help you. But honestly, I mean, today in these ages, or in this age rather, it's like there are so many companies that are like looking for people, and there's not enough people to fill those seats. And the more people that in America that know how to code, you know, the more money we have to pass around within the United States. So, I mean, that's my other sort of, like, part of that answer is, like, yeah, I, as much as we can, like, empower American citizens to code and make that money, I'm gonna just be like, yes, go do it.
Nice, nice. How is the, I guess not even just design, but what's the creative scene like in New York? With all the different talents that you have, how is the scene there?
Oh, it's really interesting here. It's kind of cool because you're, like, in New York, everyone's just, like, doing so many interesting things. And it's funny because I have, like, a coworker who came here from Atlanta, and she was like, oh, I always thought I was really busy here in Atlanta, but then I came here and I realized that, like, everyone is ridiculously busy, and now I find myself having all these crazy things to do. And I think, like, just being around so many other people who are constantly doing amazing things just makes you want to continue and keep doing really cool things and just not stop doing it. So, you know, I mean, it's awesome being born here to see, like, these different creative environments growing. I guess they've always been here in some respects. Like, you know, in the 80s and the 90s with, like, a lot of different painters and stuff, you know, that was a thing. And now it's sort of happening for tech and even for game making. It's getting really huge, which is really awesome to see happen because I love video games way too much.
So let's talk a little bit about video games. I'm a gamer too. You also started a company called Brooklyn Gamery. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So the Brooklyn Gamery is a Brooklyn born and bred company, and we're ridiculous because how that name came about is the best story. So I have like three other friends that I started this with, and we three of us except for one person are from New York City, and we've watched the whole Brooklyn scene explode, and we were just sort of like, you know, it'd be really funny because we were thinking about names. So we were like, one of them said, what if we named it the Brooklyn Gamery? Because there's, like, the Brooklyn Creamery and the Brooklyn Brewery, but there's no Brooklyn Gamery, and that'd be awesome. And so we were just like, yes, that is the best name. And we just sort of ran with it. And our slogan is handcrafted video games delivered straight to your device, and it's just perfect. And it's even better because, most of us are from New York City, so we can legitimately just say, like, you know, This is a legit born and raised in New York product. And we make a lot of cool games. We are in the process of building this game called Prism Shell. The name is also pretty ridiculous of a story. It's like, we have like a laser mechanic in the game. So it's like, you can shoot a laser, and you can also shoot regular bullets. So we took, Prism from the laser part because it's light. Then, bullet shells. And so we were just like, yeah, let's just call it Prison Shell. I don't know. That sounds like a good name. And it reminds us of, like, Metal Slug in a way, because that's kind of how they came about the name, too. And we were just like, yeah, let's do that. So we like to reference a lot of older games and things like that. And our first, you know, we're at Prison Shell. We don't know when it's going to be out yet, but we're hoping for this year. And it's going to be, like, a mobile action shooter game. So it's going to be fun.
How did you first get into game development? When a lot of people sort of talk about, like, people getting into technology, it's more about, I feel like, the web than it is about gaming. And gaming feels like very, I don't know, that feels like a little bit more abstract. Like, that's something where you really need to have, like, with school, we got a computer science degree or something. But how did you fall into doing game development?
Yeah, that's a really awesome question, because a lot of people, I think, are always wondering the same thing. Like, a lot of people I know really love games, and they want to make it, and they're just like, I don't even know, like, how do you even do that? And visiting a friend who I met in high school, and she went to NYU Poly, which is like a polytechnic school. So there's a bunch of different, like, sciences and math-related fields or majors in that school. So I went there, and I started hanging out with a lot of people who also liked games. And a couple of them were like, hey, we should, you know, make a game together, because you're like an artist and a designer, and you also code things sometimes. You know how these things work. And they were really, like, really great programmers. So what we did was we would use programs. Like, there's a program called Construct 2 that allows you to sort of string together commands, and you don't actually have to program anything, per se. But it uses programming language, and it sort of just allows you to make a game really quickly. It's like a prototyping tool, basically. And so we would use that and just make these games together, and then it sort of just, like, snowballed from there, and we kept going.
Right. So it's called Construct 2?
Yeah. Like, construction, like constructs or construct. I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, which is a question I really want to ask them. But, yeah, that's one of them. There's a lot of programs that you can actually use for making games. That's just one of them. But it's really about just sort of making things and sharing them with people. Because once we started making these things, like, I have a friend named Arthur, and he kept doing that. And he goes to a lot of events for making games as well. Like, there are hackathons specifically for making games called Game Jam. So he goes to those a lot, and that's actually where that's how we formed the Book and Gamer, is through working with people at a hackathon specifically for games. But, yeah, you know, you just sort of keep going to these games events and sharing things with people who also like games, and eventually someone sort of just, like, notices that you really love games, and, you know, you've got some practice, and it just sort of goes from there, and then suddenly you're making even bigger, more awesome games.
Nice. What kind of games do you like? Like, what are you playing now?
Currently, I really dig, like, puzzle games, platformers. My first game was Sonic, so I kind of have to love platformers. I'm playing Borderlands 2, because they have some new DLC that came out. So I'm playing that game, even though it's, like, a year old. It's got some new stuff on it, which is pretty cool. I also recently played this game called Contrast, which was a really interesting puzzle platformer. So, you know, I try to still keep up, even though I'm, like, insanely busy. Every now and then I sit down and I have to play something, because games are just awesome. There's actually this new game that's pretty cool by another person who's New York City based, and he's also a game developer, and it's called Treachery in Beatdown City. And that game looks super sweet. It's like a beat 'em up, but also an RPG at the same time. So I am super stoked for that as a person. I also like beat 'em ups a lot. So it's really cool to see when people mix genres like that. I just love seeing that kind of stuff happen. So I'm really excited to play more with that.
Nice. I am. That's so funny you mentioned that, because I am a huge fighting game fan.
Yeah.
And a huge role-playing game fan. So the fact that Beatdown City kind of combines. Yeah, I'll be checking that out.
They have a right now for it, and I cannot wait.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
More
of that. Yeah, it's really cool. And also, yes, fighting games, I am, like, high-fiving you over the phone internet, because I love them, mm-hmm. and I cannot wait for the new Smash Brothers to come out. I really want to see what they do with that. We'll see.
Now, it's funny about fighting games. So I know that I feel like people fall into one or more of a few different camps when it comes to, because I'm thinking fighting games when they really sort of came about in like the 90s. So people are really either ardent like Street Fighter fans.
Yeah.
They're ardent Tekken fans. Mm-hmm. They're ardent Mortal Kombat fans, or they're really ardent King of Fighters fans.
I think I fall
more into like the King of Fighters and Street Fighter kind of thing, and Mortal Kombat, I guess, to a degree. But which of those do you like better?
I'm more of a fan of Street Fighter. There's just like, I guess as like an interaction, you know, like UX designer, there are just things about Street Fighter that no other game really does. Like whenever you do supers and everything stops moving for a second, and then like something amazing just happens, and you're just like, oh my god, this is the most awesome thing I've ever seen someone do. And they just take it to that level, and it just, oh, there's like no other fighting game gets me hyped to that level. Like I watched Evo this past year, and I was just like, holy crap, this game is amazing. So I've always liked Street Fighter because when I was a kid, like, it was in the local laundromat, so I kind of had to play it. But, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, Street Fighter is just really cool. And, I mean, as, like, a person who cares about user experience, like, I think that's something a lot of designers should check out because, like, there's this thing that people talk about, like, the light. And Street Fighter does it really, really well. They have all these little things, like the super attack that I mentioned, that just get people really excited, and they just know what emotion they're going for, and they just work with that, and I love it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would imagine since you build games also, you sort of see it from a different technical standpoint than just like the average fighting game fan, the average layperson, you know?
Yeah, totally. And it's funny because my boyfriend is also, he goes to the point of like knowing things about games, like the hitboxes and stuff, which I also have to care about, but he knows how to cheat those things. And I'm just, there's a point where I have to be like, if I get too far in, I cannot enjoy this game as much. So I look at it from a design standpoint and sometimes from a development standpoint. But if I did that too much, I would be paying way too much attention to like the technical stuff and not having enough fun. So I always try to like turn on and off those things in my brain so I can still have fun with stuff.
I hear you. Yeah, I like Street Fighter because when I first started playing Street Fighter, it was like the original like Street Fighter 1.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was a Street Fighter, and Ryu was like a ginger, and he had all these. It was funny because like the console only had two buttons, and they were huge. They were about as big as like a paper plate. And you have to like punch down the button. I don't know if you've seen this, but
I've seen like at least Street Fighter 2. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Like so like the only thing that Ryu could do was I think jump and like punch kick, and I think he could do a Hadouken. But you had these big huge buttons that you had to like physically like punch down, and then they had all these different cities and different people. So like he would fight Adon and Sagat and Birdie and I think some other people. And what I always thought was funny is that it was like one of the first games that I played that had talking in it. The other games that I remember that had that sort of voice, that kind of voice acting were usually Konami games, like,
mm-hmm.
The Adventures of Bayou Billy comes to mind or something. But, after every round, the guys would say the same thing in the same voice. They say something like, oh god, I can't remember what it is. It's like, good fight. Just remember, there are people like you all over the world. Like, it's like the same thing every single time.
There's something about it amazing, right?
Yeah, and like, I have fond memories of Street Fighter because of that. I liked King of Fighters because it had so many characters. And it was like, you could play on a team of three. They had a lot of women characters. They had characters of different nationalities, so I liked that. And they had a story that carried over from game to game. I feel like the Street Fighter chronology is a little kind of messy a little bit. But King of Fighters, it sort of was like King of Fighters 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, and it had a story that built, and then you had these story arcs that changed every 3 years, I was really into that for some reason, because it felt like these were characters that you grew with, and it wasn't just, you know, like the same guy or whatever. But it's not all about gaming. I could talk, we could have a whole gaming podcast. I don't want to get too far, far off of,
That is totally okay, because I could talk about that all day. I even read a Street Fighter wiki just so I could understand what was happening in the game. Do not worry.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess, diversity in this field. I mean, you're a black woman who is a designer, a coder, a gamer. Like, I'm sure you probably had some really interesting experiences just cohabitating all these spaces. What are some of the more, I guess, interesting kind of encounters that you've had since you've been working in the field?
Yeah, well, it's always been really interesting because, you know, just being a gamer and a woman at the same time has kind of been, like, already kind of off-putting to some people. But, you know, being a black person in a field where there are not many, it's kind of intimidating at times, doubly so when you're also a woman. It's been an interesting journey. I guess it's weird for me because when I was a kid, I was a tomboy, so I was kind of uncomfortable around women a lot and much more so comfortable with, like, being around a lot of guys. So I got used to that. And, you know, it also gaming. So I don't particularly feel like, I usually feel kind of okay, but when you're, like, in the minority in multiple ways, you definitely feel it a lot. And it's hard sometimes to not just feel affected by that constantly. And, you know, that's one of the things I struggle with a lot, especially when I was working at NASDAQ. Also because, you know, I was one of two or three black people in the office. And like, there were like three black women, actually. I think there was like one black guy and I was the only one who was like on the design team. And culture wise, it was just, very, interesting. And, you know, I learned a lot about myself. As well as other people. But, you know, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's really, it's hard sometimes. Sometimes, you know, I found myself, like, when I would go to certain meetups, I would sort of stand there and I would feel kind of uncomfortable because I would notice I was the only woman or the only black person, or sometimes even just the only young person in the room. And I would wonder to myself, is no one talking to me because I'm black or because I'm a woman, or is it just me that's pushing everyone else away? So one thing you definitely learn as a person who's a minority in tech is, you know, you learn a lot about yourself, but you also sometimes have a lot of questions that are going to be really hard to answer if it's all possible. So, you know, I'm still, that's one of the things I'm still working on. But, you know, hopefully, one of the reasons I am a teacher with this group called Code Liberation is because sometimes tech can be really uncomfortable for women. A lot of the times when you're speaking with men as a woman and you're in tech, you don't really know if they're speaking to you because they're interested in what you do or if they're interested in like dating you or whatever the case may be. So it can feel really uncomfortable. And one of the things we're trying to do is actually build a space that women can feel safe in, and, you know, make things together and not feel like they're, being targeted for any kind of creepy thing. But otherwise, I mean, I really like the field, and, I actually really love, where I work right now, at Bedrocket, because, they're really welcoming, and we have a really great ratio of, like, men to women. And I may be the only black person in the room, but I'm not the only minority in the room, which is kind of a rare case, actually. So I never feel like, I never feel too alone when I'm here. And I really like that.
Yeah, there's this adage that I've heard it in different, in different ways, but I remember most recently hearing it from a video on YouTube where, the guy was talking about racism and games.
Yeah.
It's this YouTube show called PBS Game Show, and it's done by this guy. I think he's in New York. His name is Jamin Warren. Have you seen this?
I've seen it. Yeah, I've seen a lot of their stuff, and they are really great and really introspective. I love
them. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that. But he said something in there where he's like, you can't be what you don't see. And I feel like particularly with design and technology, I know that the pervading notion is how this is a really, this is a field that's about merit. It's a meritocracy. And that in itself is true in some respects. Like, it is about making sure that you are doing the work, that you're an active member of the community because you can do the work. However, you know, you also can't discount the power of being able to see a woman that's doing it, of seeing a black person that's doing it, a person that's doing it. Like, for people that are just getting into this industry, for students, for kids, to see role models that look like them, that resemble them in some way, is huge. It's huge. It's more than just about merit at that point.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's one of the reasons I've been trying really hard to speak. Actually, and do like public speaking and teaching is because, when I was a kid, like, you know, I didn't really know anyone, who was interested in things like that and was older than me. Like, I never really had a role model to that level, and it would have been super cool if I did. But I sort of grew up, just thinking like, you know, my mom at that point was my role model because I didn't really, you know anyone else who I thought was really cool. But, you know, she always appreciated technology a lot, and she really encouraged me to do it. So just having her there to be so encouraging was really great for me. But a lot of kids don't have that, and especially a lot of, like, black women, you know, I don't always know how much people expect of black women, especially, like, my cousins. I'm always, like, shoving them to do stuff because otherwise no one would be doing that. And, you know, I'm trying to do that for other young black girls as well, and also young black boys, because, you know, if there's a black woman doing this, it's much more possible. You know, it just feels like it's something they can actually do. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to speak at, like, user experience conferences. I hope to do some at, like, development conferences for, like, web, and also game making, because it's super duper rare. Like, I went to IndieCade this past weekend, which IndieCade is a game development conference, and it's located, they have two versions. They have a version in New York and a version in California, I believe. And so I went to the New York one, and I was one of, like, maximum five black people specifically. And there were definitely, like, thousands of people there, and it was to the point where this guy got confused for another guy because they both had afros and glasses.
Oh,
but one had, like, a giant beard, and it was impossible to mistake him. He has a giant, gigantic beard, and it's just like, what?
Oh,
how does that happen? Yeah, so it's just, like, we definitely need more people in all of these fields. Like, it's still happening that we don't have enough. And hopefully by, you know, speaking up and, you know, trying to show other people that I'm here, I can help to sort of change that ratio in addition to being a woman, you know? So hoping.
And I think, I mean, it's important, you know, also for, you know, we're going back to talking about, you know, the PBS game show, but about representation within these games. Like, I'm thinking about, and you probably know what I'm talking about, I'm thinking about that non-playable character in Deus Ex Human Revolution, the woman that meet in the alley. Oh, my God. And she's like, I'll be right here waiting for you. About, like, who thought that was a good idea?
Yeah. Like,
Oh, my God. Who?
Disappointment.
It was
really bad. There's also another character actually that people got super mad at. It's in Borderlands 2, and her name's Tiny Tina, and she's like a little girl, and she was raised. She had lost her parents, and she was raised by this army dude, and his name was Roland, and he was really cool, and he also happened to be black. So Tiny Tina herself, I am not really sure what color, ethnicity, race, whatever she is. But she's got, like, possibly black features. Like, she has, like, a nose that's sort of more invocative of, like, black people. It's sort of, like, it's, like, wider and, like, kind of flatter, and it's just, she sort of feels like she could, I don't really know what she is, but the way she speaks is more what people associate with, like, talking street or like someone from the South. Like she says a lot of ridiculous, awesome things, and I immediately loved her character. But a lot of people were just like, she's racist. And I was just super frustrated because, you know, I mean, it's really rare that there's a character like that. And she wasn't like, she was actually, like, she was really short. She was pretty skinny. Her ethnicity was, like, not really, you can really point it out. But people just automatically jumped and said, like, she's racist because she has, like, light skin. So people were like, she's a white chick talking like a black girl. And we can't have that in games. And I was just like, I really like the character. And I'm a black girl. What does that say about me? I mean, my boyfriend also completely loves her character. And you know, it's just like, I think we have a lot of work to do in terms of, like, communication and accepting that some people, you know, if she is white as a character, like, as a person, rather, then, you know, there are white people in the South that talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think we have to sort of, like, broaden our scope. And also, you know, I think if we have more people of color, like, especially black people in these games, like, then maybe people, you know, I mean, if we just had more representation, this wouldn't really be as much of a thing because we would have people from the South, but we'd also have people who are from the Bronx who possibly talk like me. And, you know, everyone always says, like, I speak really weird. But, you know, this is just the way I talk. And, you know, if we had that in games too, where it's like, story of a black girl who doesn't exactly talk like she's from the South, and other people, even, you know, just having that range would be really amazing, and I want to be a part of making that happen. So that's definitely one of my focuses, amongst a range of other things, like female representation in video games lately.
I would totally love to see more black people in role-playing games.
Yeah.
Because like I grew up, and I mean, I think as any role playing game enthusiast, they sort of cut their teeth on Final Fantasy. And I remember playing Final Fantasy, like the first one on NES, and I remember when Final Fantasy II came out on Super Nintendo, and I just fell in love with it. And you know, a lot of these types of role playing games are usually always centered around this sort of European medieval motif, where you've got you know, swords and armor and kings and queens and stuff like that. And Final Fantasy III came out on Super Nintendo, and I mean, I completely fell in love with it. I actually learned how to read music from Final Fantasy II and III because I would record the songs, and then I would transpose the music so I could learn, like, the notes and stuff. So when Final Fantasy VII came out on PlayStation, I was so excited because I had just gotten the PlayStation. I was like, oh my God, it's Final Fantasy VII. It's going to be great. There's a black character in it. As a black male character, and he kind of like had the same build and stuff as my dad, I was like, yes, as a black character in Final Fantasy VII, I'm going to buy it, I'm going to play it. And when I tell you, I was so disappointed in that. Like, why does he talk like Mr. T in this post-apocalyptic role-playing game? And like, to this day, like, I can't even play through Final Fantasy VII. Like, it's my least favorite of the entire series.
Yeah, every time I see it, I'm just like, there's just like a wave of disappointment that just comes over me, and I don't even want to touch Final Fantasy.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, they kind of, like, Final Fantasy had, whoever the bunny woman was, and I think that was in 12, I think her name was Freya, something like that.
And then even
13 had, Saz with the afro, and I was just like,
Yeah,
I guess it's better.
Stereotypes, but yeah, it's like, what can you say? I don't know. It's like, I think if we have more people who are actually black making these characters, then we'll get a lot less stereotypes and a lot of like actual human beings. I always think the problem is like they sort of go for the caricature of what they might have seen, whether it's on TV or if it's actually in real life, without actually realizing that these are real people with more than just one feeling, or like not even a feeling, but like their entire entity is not just sass. Like there's nothing else there besides just a sassy person. And a lot of people don't understand that often. And I mean, I think a part of that is also like the way a lot of black people deal with like pain and everything really is like some kind of joke about it. But that's because, you know, that's like a thing that we sort of get.
Yeah, I laugh to keep from crying.
Yeah, exactly. Like, stuff just kind of sucks sometimes, and our way of dealing with it is by making a joke about it. And so it's like people automatically see that, and then they're like, oh, maybe this is just how my time. Or like, look at Mr. T. He's cool. I don't know. It's just a lot of weird issues. But I feel like if a person of color is actually making these things, then this is going to be less likely to happen, because they'll know what it's like when someone gets home and, you know, they're like crying because something bad happened and they don't have to put on a face in front of other people. And I'm just really hopeful that that's going to be the direction that people go in more often.
I feel like this also plays out in technology, too. I totally feel like this plays out the same way in technology because, and I think mostly not design so much, but certainly in technology. So I don't know if you heard about this. This happened maybe about, gosh, when was this? I think this was like 2006, 2007 maybe. It was a while ago. And, you know, there's always been this kind of perennial conversation, I feel, about increasing racial diversity in technology, and I think lately, within the past 2 or 3 years, that's spilled over into the design field. But with technology, it's about, you know, making sure that there are more, you know, black people that are being represented and things of that nature. And this guy who is a comedian slash tech pundit or something, I don't know, this guy named Lauren Feldman, and he did this spoof, I guess, of a black tech entrepreneur. Oh my God, it's so bad. I don't even know what to call it. But no, it's he did this video spoof, and I'll link to it in the show notes. But he did this video spoof of this website called it's called TechNigga.com.
Oh God, why?
And yeah, he's a white guy, so it's like TechNigga.com, and we have this, and he's dressed in like. He has like a do-rag and shades and earrings and stuff, like trying to dress like the stereotypical black rapper or whatever. And, he's like, oh, and we have our app is called hoetracker.com. So you can track your hoes while you're on the go. And it's like, what? And the thing was that this was on a show that he did that was like sponsored by Verizon. It was on, what was the name of the network at the time? Pod something. This is back when podcasting was like the rage back then.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it was really bad. And, you know, people complained and, you know, they pulled the funding and ended up canceling the show or whatever. It was like 1938 Media was the company. And I never even addressed all of this at South by Southwest even. Like, there was a panel about blacks and technology and he was like in the audience, like lobbing questions at people, you know, because people were like, oh, I don't see why this is a bad thing. It's satire. No, it's not satirical. It's pretty insulting.
Yeah.
Like, it's not satire.
It hurts people.
Yeah, it hurts people. And so, I mean, I think now it certainly has widened the scope in terms of this whole, you know, like, black and technology, you know, kind of thing. But it's sort of like you're saying, like, there's even still companies that are doing, like, really foul and crazy stuff around, you know, women, around racial minority, you know, and it's like, clearly you don't have these people at the table when these sort of decisions come up, because someone would have to check you and say, that's a terrible idea, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like now it's more so around gender than around race, but it's still,
yeah.
It still crops up every now and then.
Yeah, that stuff just, I don't even understand what, like, I'm just kind of speechless from frustration from that, because I always feel like sometimes people have the best, like they really want the best for people sometimes, and then like these things come out of their mouth, and then other people are just like, why did you think that was a good idea? And I don't think that's in this case, that is not true. I don't see how someone can say that and not realize that, you know, a lot of black people are not like that. And I think that's one of the things I always get frustrated about, actually, is, like, there's such a large percentage of black people that are, like, nerdy and actually consume a lot of technology already. The issue is usually around turning them from the people who are consuming technology into the people who are actually creating it. So it's not really as much, like, you know, how do we make this cool and hip for the kids? It's actually, how do we just involve the kids in making it so they can figure out what they want to make by themselves? So, you know, I mean, if we just I think what we really have to do is start encouraging, you know, Black children at a younger age to start building things, and also sort of pointing them out as like creative tools rather than like another boring kind of educational thing. And education is like a whole other subject for me, because like I love reading and I love like doing math has always been really entertaining for me and stuff. But for some people, that's not the case. And if we sort of highlight it as something that's actually fun and allows you to do a lot of creative things, I think people would really enjoy that. And in addition, obviously, it also sort of financially empowers you. And a lot of kids also want to be financially independent and want to be able to buy whatever they want. And showing them that they can fund whatever they enjoy doing instead of like having to rely on their parents or whatever may be the case, it's also another super great way to get kids interested. So I think sometimes we need to look beyond the sort of like stereotypical reasons why someone might be not be interested in something, and really start to like figure out how we can start involving them in a way that's more comfortable for them. Because if I ever see anyone actually making a site like that, I will gladly fly to wherever the creator lives and punch him in the face. That is not cool. It is really not cool. And that makes me really sad that exists. I can't. The internet. It's how many things.
So let's shift the conversation away from it, because I think we're both a little keyed up right now. But Let's talk about your personal, like, design style. Of course, I know you also do illustrations, and you also have, like, a few comics, I think you've done. I saw one or two of them on Tumblr. How would you sort of describe your personal design style? Who are some of your influences?
A lot of my influence comes from, like, comics and cartoons, actually. I love colors, and I can do minimalism, and I mean, that's one of the great things about being an artist is that you sort of learn to emulate other styles. So that's sort of one of the things I learned is like, if someone needs a certain kind of style, you should be able to sort of create something that sort of feels like that. So I guess it's hard to say what exactly my design style is. Personally, I love using, like, as much color as possible and being sort of, like, radical about things. When it comes to a website, I care more about, like, how people can use it or whatever its specific function is supposed to be. So I guess one of the things I really believe in form following function, and I want something to look good because this is the internet, and I care a lot about visuals, but I really want to make something as useful as possible, and then sort of care about how to make it look beautiful afterwards. And I think that's why I do really well with user experience design, because at least when it comes to certain practices of user experience, it's really about how do you make this function the best and get people to do what they love or need to do the quickest, and then how do we make it look really amazing after we've cared about the task at hand.
Mm-hmm. Are there any personal projects that you're working on right now? I know you mentioned Brooklyn Gamery. You've mentioned Code Liberation Foundation. Is there anything else that you're working on? Any other personal projects?
Yeah, I mean, I always have little things like, you know, my comics website. I'm always drawing something on there. I'm also, like, anytime I think of a hilarious domain name, I immediately buy it and, like, make a website for it. So I have little ones, like I have to at some point make, I think I have like don'tpressthisbutton.com or something. I have to make that. I've got a lot of little things. And when I have nothing else to do, you know, like I have a plan to make at least 5 video games this year, and I've already made 2 of them. So I work on that.
Wow.
And yeah, and I also, you know, as I said, I teach with, Code Liberation. I'm also, you know, I also teach, little kids to code in general. So I'm going to be teaching some girls through the YWCA, and we're going to go through how to make an HTML5 game. So that's going to be fun. So I'm never bored, ever.
It sounds like, yeah. I mean, the whole thing about making video games, that just, like, blows my mind, Grace, because I want to learn how to do that, and especially role-playing games. That just have a real penchant for role playing games. So that's awesome. That's really awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's not nearly as hard as you would think. It's the barrier always seems really high, but there are so many programs out there, especially now, that are catered towards people that don't know how to make a game yet, and it really sort of walks them through it. So Construct, as we mentioned, is one. There's also like Game Maker. It's actually called Game Maker. It's just perfect. But that one is also really great. And Unity actually has a 2D platformer engine now, so you can make 2D platformers in Unity at this point. And there's just so many resources. I think the big issue is like showing people that they're there and pointing them out constantly until, you know, they see that they're available.
Where do you see yourself in like the next 5 years or so? Because it sounds like you've got a lot going on, a lot of different fronts. Where do you see yourself in the near future?
That is an amazing question. That is so hard. it's hard to say. I'm really hoping to just continue making a lot of really beautiful, wonderful experiences for people, whether it's online or whether it's like in a video game form. I just love doing those things so much, and I want to continue being able to do both of them. And at some point in the future, I would love to actually make like a graphic novel type thing. I would love to do that. But it's hard to say. I just know that I want to keep making things, and I'm never going to stop making stuff, and I just want to do that for the rest of my life.
Nice. Yeah, I know with Kickstarter, I know there's a lot of people that are doing graphic novels from that. There's this one artist in particular. She's on Tumblr, but she goes by GGDG. I don't know if that name sounds familiar. She has this webcomic called Cucumber Quest, which is like about
the...
Yeah, it's like these anthropomorphic bunnies on this like classic role playing quest. It's pretty neat, and she's already like successfully raised thousands of dollars off two Kickstarters to like do books and stuff. So if you decide to go that route, Kickstarter seems to be the way to go, especially if you have an audience built up around it. It totally seems like the way to go.
Yeah, that's awesome because I love animals. It's funny because I actually kickstarted a graphic novel called Dr. Cat. It's about a cat who's a doctor. And it's so cute. I had to immediately give it money because it started as a webcomic. And I loved it because it was like this cat that has a glove, like an operating glove on its tail. And it's just so wacky and out there. I just loved it. So, yeah, I mean, I love Kickstarter, and I love what they're doing, that they're empowering people to make stuff and to not have that sort of middleman there controlling their creative voice. And, I mean, that just sort of goes back to, like, the power of being able to code and create things, because someone made that and figured out a way to build a system that allows people to pay other people to make things that are awesome. And, you know, that wouldn't be possible if someone hadn't figured out how to code.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to wrap up the interview, where can our readers find you online?
My website's pretty simple. It's catsmall.com, two T's, because special, I guess. And besides that, I also operate codeliberation.org. I also run brooklyngamery.com. So those are my three main websites that I exist on.
All right. Sounds good. Cat Small, thank you again so much for taking time out of your day. I was glad we were able to talk about tech and design and video games. This was a really great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been so fun, and I love talking about that stuff. So I'm so happy I could do this.
All right.
And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Cat Small, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to take our survey at revisionpath.com/survey and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Revision Path is a 318 Media project. If you like what we're doing with these podcasts, you can help sponsor the show. Contact information will be included in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.